Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. In this episode, I want to take a step back, actually a couple of step backs for some of you, and talk about something that you may, if you've been around Linux for a while, you may think you already understand. And I think many of us do mostly understand, but there are subtleties to this topic. And if you're new to this, to Linux, then this would be new to you and it would be new information. But I mean, either way, I think that this is kind of interest to a lot of people. And it's one of those things that I think after a fashion, you start to either take for granted or just accept that it's really, really confusing and big in scope and it's beyond your understanding. So you'll just kind of look for an explanation when it comes up. What is this? What is this topic that I'm talking about? It's file permissions. And I know you're thinking, if you've been using Linux, you're thinking, I already know this, but wait, there are subtleties to file permissions that some of us don't realize. For instance, if I were to ask you about a file that was set to read only, read, so that's 444, and I said, I want you to rename that file without using sudo or su, would you say that that was possible? If you say that that's not possible, then you don't know as much about Unix file permissions as you thought you did. How's that for a hook? Okay, so it turns out that file permissions, I mean, it is a bigger topic than I think either we realize, or it is as big as we realize, and that's why we don't delve too deeply into it. It really is a complex issue, and it seems kind of simple on the surface, but I was looking for documentation on the subject beyond the obvious. You know, the obvious documentation, the obvious articles online, the dime a dozen chapters in every single Linux training manual goes through the way that you set, you know, the way that you add up the numbers and come up with 777 or 755 or 700 or 644, you know, whatever. And that's kind of, and then maybe they also mention graciously the shortcuts like U plus R, U plus RWX, comma G plus X, comma O minus WX. And that's, it's very trite, it tends to be, because it just kind of, it does make it seem like a very simple process, which is, I mean, that's, sometimes that's good, that sometimes that is actually all you need to know. But again, there are subtleties, and I wish there was that other level of articles, and you really don't see it. And I thought, well, maybe that sort of thing is explained in Chmod. Maybe that's the man page of Chmod would explain that. It doesn't tell you. Chmod assumes you already understand this stuff. Chmod assumes you already read all the training manuals, and all you need is a reminder of how to use, just sort of like, what's this thing about file permissions? Hey, here's the real quick paragraph about it, and here's the options you might need when using this command. That's it. The actual documentation is sort of, I don't know if buried is the right term, but it's there. You just have to look for it. It's an info page, and it is info space quote file space permissions close quote. That'll get you to at least on Slackware chapter or you know, node 27 file permissions. That's where I'm put when I type that in. I got here the long way around, but that's the shortcut to get right here. You just do info space quote file permissions close quote. And you're there. And you can read all about it. You start with the mode structure, the symbolic modes, the numeric modes, the operator numeric modes, and the director set uid and set gid commands. And it's a really interesting read. But what I decided, I was going to take a very systematic approach to this issue, like really trying to understand all the subtleties of file permissions. And so I created a directory for every possible combination, not every possible combination, for every mode of of execution of rather file permissions. So I created a directory called just top level, and I left that as the default permissions for my system, which is 775 is what I have that set to. Maybe that wasn't the default, but that's what I set it to anyway. And this is, I gave myself, I've got a user, I've got a group that I'm a member of, and then of course there would be other, which would be some other user that I would have to create on the system, which let's not worry about that too much yet. So I got a directory here, dir077. So the permissions on that, if I do an ls-l in top level, I see that dir077 has the permissions of blank 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 rwx rwx. And just in case you are unfamiliar with this stuff, rwx is read, write, and execute, which according to the info pages on file permissions indicates permission to read the file. For directories, this means permission to list the contents of the directory. Okay, so that's R. And that's worth, you could think of it as 400 points. And I'm doing it in the hundreds and tens and ones places because that's how it gets structured in the end. So 400 for reading if you're the user who created, who owns the file. Write is permission to write to parentheses change, close parentheses, the file. For directories, this means permissions to create and remove files in the directory. So that's worth 200 points if you're the user who owns that file. And then finally, you have permissions to execute the file, that is, run it as a program. For directories, this means permission to access files in the directory. And that is worth 100 points if you're the user who owns the file. So that means that if you have read, write, and execute permissions, that's 400 plus 200, that's 600, plus 100, that's 700, 7. It's a 700 value for that file. Now there, you have to do that same operations for the group who owns the file. That's 40, 20, and 10 points. And then you have to do the same process for all the other users on the system that might, for some reason, be able to see the directory, top-level directory, and that would be 4, 2, and 1. So in the end, you get, like, 777. Well, that's all access. Everyone, both the owner of the file, the group who owns the file, and everybody else on the system can read, write, and execute 777 that file, and so on. So in this example, 077 means that I have, as the owner of that file, I have no permissions of any kind, read, write, or execute for this directory, I should say. And then everyone else, the group of which I'm a member, and everyone else on the system can read, write, and execute. So you might think from sort of just hearing about that cascading level of ownership and permissions, you might think that in a directory, for a directory marked 077, that as the user who owns the file, I have no ability to look into the directory. But I am a member of the group that owns that directory, so I should be able to look into it as a member of that group. But let's test that out. If I do an ls dir077, cannot open directory dir077, permission denied. So even though I'm a member of the group, because I am the user who owns the that directory, and I am explicitly forbidden from looking into that directory, the user permissions supersede the group permissions, and I cannot see into the directory. Even though that's my directory, I created it as this user, Klaatu. I'm a member of the group, Klaatu, or users, or whatever it is. But because my username matches, or rather my user ID, matches the user ID that has zero permissions, I cannot look into that directory. Okay, so if you knew that, then congratulations, that's impressive. I didn't know that before doing this, so that had been a surprise to me when I sat down to do that. Okay, so let's talk about what if we set a bit in here that that gives Klaatu execute permissions on that directory. Well, let's go real quick up to info, file permissions, go down to mode structure. It says permission to execute the file, run it as a program. Or for directories, this means permission to access files in the directory. Okay, so I'm going to do a ls on dir 177. So I've set the execute bit on this directory. And now I'm going to do an ls. And what do you think, dear listener? Do you think that I could see into that directory? Or do you think I cannot see into that directory with the execute bit for my user set? So the permissions for this are 177. I've given myself 100 points for executable bit 177. Can I see into that directory? No, cannot see into that directory. It says cannot open directory 177, permission denied. So the interesting question then maybe is, well, how can you access something if permission is denied to look into the directory? Well, what if we were to do something like touch dir 177 slash foo. Can I create a file in that directory? Dir cannot touch dir 177 touch. Cannot touch dir 177 slash foo, permission denied. So executable bits not helping me a whole lot here. Okay, well, let's increment the permissions again. Let's add another 100 to it. We'll end up with a directory called dir 277, and if I look at the permissions of that, sure enough, it's nothing w, nothing wrx, wrx. So again, as the user who owns this directory, I have write permission only. It's because I've added, you know, I've incremented the bits assigned to this, to the file mode. All right, let's do our ls test again on 277. Cannot open. That's not surprising at this point. I don't have execute and I don't have write. I don't have read. All I have is write. It doesn't really imply anything about looking into the directory. What you might expect, though, maybe is a touch dir 277 slash foo, because you can, you can write. You have the write bit. But once again, if we go to that file permission node and we look at the definition of write, permission to write to or change the file. For directories, this means permission to create and remove files in the directory. So this should, in theory, work. And yet, touch dir 277 foo failed. Okay, I guess another good test is to cd into dir, for instance, 277. Or, yeah, a cd test is actually, would be good to do. So let's see what happens if I cd into dir 277. It says permission denied. But what if I try to cd into dir 177, the one with execute bit set? Well, that actually works. I can't list anything once I'm there. I can't touch a file, but I can cd in and out of a directory with the execute bit set, but not the directory with just the W set. So what kind of powers do I gain if I have both? Well, let's increment that bit again. So now I've got dir 377. So if I do an ls on 377, you can't open the directory. Can I touch a file in dir 377? Yes, I could touch dir 377 slash foo, successfully created a file called foo, presumably, in dir 377. Presumably. I say presumably because if I do an ls of 377, I can't see into it. So I'm taking it on faith that foo got created. Can I cd into 377? Yes, I can. Still can't read the contents of 377. So I'm going to just cheat a little bit here and do a sudo ls just to double make sure that foo is there. And yes, of course it is there. So that's good. That actually did work. And it got created with the default permissions for my system, which is apparently 664. I guess that must be the... Yeah, that makes sense for a that very, very much makes sense. Okay, so that's great. So 377 or right? Yeah, 377 is kind of an exciting benchmark for us at this point. We were able to CD into a directory. We were able to make a file there. We just weren't ever allowed to see the file. I wonder if we went into back into 377, let's do, for instance, an echo hello world into foo. That works, of course. And then let's do a cat on foo, and that works. So we can, I guess, in that indirect way, we can confirm that foo is there. But if you do an ls on, you know, in that directory, you can't see it. So that's a really unusual state to be in. And I don't imagine you would typically find yourself in that state. I mean, this is, I don't know why someone would have the permission set to 377, except maybe by accident. But that's an interesting spot. Okay, enough of 377. Let's take a look at the next level up, which is 477. So 477 means that I've got 400 points in my user mode, my file permission mode. 400, if you'll recall, mapped to the read ability. And I guess I could go back to the file permissions node in info and look up read. It says permission to read the file. Yeah. For directories, this means permission to list the contents of a directory. So that's exciting, possibly. So if I do an ls on 477, it doesn't give me an error. I think that's what the first time I've not gotten a list error, right? So that's really neat. Of course, the directory is empty because I'm like I said, I'm literally creating new directory. I created a new directory for each file mode. So each directory that exists starts out empty. So this is a new directory with permissions 477 and it's empty, but I can list that it is empty. If I do something like echo hello into dir 477 foo, however, permission is denied. And of course I was just doing that as sort of a shortcut. I could also, I could also just touch dir 477 foo. Doesn't matter, it won't let me. I have no permissions to do that. Can I CD into 477? What do you think, dear listener? If you said that permission would be denied, you're correct. Read doesn't give me the permissions to change directory to that location. It simply lets me list the files in that directory. And that's it. That's what 477, or that's what read permission gives you. Okay, well, what if we do read and execute? That would be 577, because that's 400 points for read, 100 points for execute, 500, 577. If I do an ls on 577, as you can imagine by now, you're probably catching on, that's permitted. I can do that. But can I touch a file in 577? That's the question. I have to type the name of the directory correctly and in order to determine that. Touch dir 577 slash foo, permission denied. And you may have anticipated that because probably getting the idea that the right bit wasn't set, so that wasn't going to work. And as it turns out, that is correct. It does not, in fact, work. So that's read and execute. Now, of course, because I have that execute bit set, I can CD into the directory. I can list the empty directory. It's just that I can't seem to. If I do echo hello into foo, doesn't work. Yeah, it just doesn't. I can't create a file in 577. Okay, so if I increment this to 677, which gives me 600, of course, is 400 for the read bit, and then 200 for the write bit, and then nothing for the X, the no 100. So 4 plus 2 is 600. So that's read and write. So I would anticipate that I could list 677. And do you remember whether or not I'll be able to create a file in here, dear listener, with read and write permissions set? Can I touch foo? No, cannot. Permission denied. Why is that? Because the execute bit isn't there. If there was a WX, I could create a file, remember that. But I wouldn't be able to see it. I wouldn't be able to list the contents of the directory. I could cat the contents of the file. But in this case, there's no execute. I can't make a file appear there. Well, the only one left is 777. So that's RWX. So once again, we would anticipate the ability to list files in dir 777. And I should be able to echo hello into dir 777 foo. And then of course I could list it again to actually see that foo exists. And I could cat foo to get my hello message. I can cd into 777. So of all the experiments that I've done here, two of them successfully permitted me to create a file called foo in a directory. And those two settings were the one with W and X set and the one with RWX set. So in other words, the magic combo, if you want to create files anyway, WX, that's important. So now let's look at the effects of permissions as they cascade and interact with one another. So for instance, I'm going to go to the dir 777 directory. I mean, again, it's just the important thing here is that first seven, like the 77 at the end. In this case, as I've shown, doesn't actually affect anything. I am the user who owns these directories and the files that I'm creating. So the last two values could be anything. They could be zero. It wouldn't matter because the computer sees me as the user who owns these files and directories. It's not basing any of its interactions on the group permissions or on, you know, it's not treating me as a group member. It's not treating me as certainly other user. It's treating me as the user, and that's what it's basing these permissions off of. Okay, so I'm in 777. I'm in a 7 read, write, and execute environment. I have this file called foo. The file foo has 664 permissions. So again, the only one that actually matters in this instance is the RW at the very front, the 600. So it's telling me that I have read and write permissions on foo. So if I cat foo, I sure can read it because it just said hello. If I echo world and then redirect into foo and then cat foo again, I get hello world. So I've just written to it. Can I execute it? If I do a ./foo, says bash foo permission denied. So no, it will not run foo as a shell script. I guess really quickly, I could make this a shell script so that test has a little bit more meaning. So I'm going to do an echo space single quote hash exclamation mark /bin/sh, and then I'll do echo again, and then I'll do single quote echo hello, close single quote, redirect to foo. And now if I cat foo, I've got shebang /bin/bash echo hello on the second line. So in theory, and I guess I could test the theory, sh./foo, that does run it as a script, because I'm not running it as a script. I'm launching a subshell that uses the contents of foo as its input, and it processes it and spits out hello. Okay, so here we are. We've got read and write permissions for foo. Well, I guess let's just cycle through the permissions again. So I'm going to do a chmod 0, I don't know, 77 on foo, and now I shouldn't be able to do anything with foo. Cat foo, nope. Echo world, redirect into foo, permission denied. And then I guess just for kicks, let's do a ./foo, just make sure that we can't run it as a script. Nope, can't run it as a script. What if I did a sh./foo, permission denied? So it won't even run foo as a script when preceded by sh, because I don't have permission, right? Okay, so I mean, obviously, if I try to, for instance, let's just try to move mv foo to bar, that's not going to work, right? Right? What do you think, dear listener? Do you think that's going to work? It works. Move foo to bar when permissions are 077 or 000, if you like, that works. In fact, I could do that. I could do a chmod, well, pseudo chmod. Well, actually, no, let's do that. Chmod as normal user, Klaatu, 000 to, well, now it's called bar. So if I do an ls-l, I've got zero permissions on bar. Now I'm going to move bar to foo, and guess what? It works. Now, if you didn't think that was possible, Well, join the club. I mean, it kind of takes you by surprise if you don't really, really think about what's going on here. And what's going on here is that this file, foo, exists in a directory you have execute permissions on that directory. So you can affect the contents of the directory. You just can't act upon the contents of the contents of the directory, if that makes any sense. So if I do a cat on foo, of course, permission is denied. If I try to echo something into foo, it's denied. If I try to execute it, it's denied. Moving the file, however, is considered a directory function, not a file function. And I think that especially is a little bit puzzling, because you think, well, but I'm changing the file. But you're not. You're changing the listing of the file, believe it or not. And because you have sufficient permissions on the directory, you have permission to control, to affect the directory listing. Okay, so I'm going to back out of here. I'm going to move this directory 777 to just, I don't know, AAA, or test, I guess, would be easier. But really, how about A test would be better, because I want it to... How about Z test? No, A test is easier to say. Okay, so now I've got A test, ls-l, 777 on A test. Okay, good. So I'm going to do a chmod 677. Do I want to do that? I don't think I want to do that. So, well, I'll do it just in the interest of completion. 677 of A test. So if I try to go into A test, of course, permissions denied. If I try to move A test foo to a test bar, permission is denied, because I can't, the executable bit is not set. So there's no surprise there, I don't think. So now I'm going to move that down to 577 for a test. So now I can go into a test because that executable bit is set. Got 577, so it's read for 400, execute for 100. There's no 200 point set, so it's just 4 and 1, 5. That's the 577. And foo is still 000, nothing. Now can I move foo to bar? Well, I've got the read and the execute. Seems pretty good. Can I move foo to bar? No, I cannot move foo to bar. Why can't I move foo to bar? Is it because of foo's permissions? So if I chmod like 777 to foo, does that, now can I move it to bar? Foo to bar? No. Still can't move foo to bar. So again, a little bit confusing here, because the file itself has its own permissions, but it's being governed when we're trying to rename it by the directory listing. And the directory listing we can read, we can move into the directory itself, but we cannot write. There's no write permission for the directory. And writing a directory listing is part of the W permission, and so we cannot move foo to bar, nor could we touch bar or touch baz or anything else. There's no write permission on this in this environment. That's not something that we have in a 500 file permission mode. There's just no write bit set. So can't move foo, even if its own permissions say that I have full control over foo. So for instance, in a 577 directory, I can do echo single quote echo world close single quote redirect into foo. I can cat foo to see that it's still a shell script. I could even execute foo right now, right? Because I've got the execute bit set all of a sudden. So if I do a dot slash foo, I see the output, hello world. So it's functioning. I can write to it. I can write to that file, that is. I can execute that file. I can read the file by doing a cat on foo itself. I can read the contents of foo. I can write to the contents of foo. I can execute foo because I gave foo permission to do all of those things, or myself permission to do all of those things to foo. But the directory listing itself only allows me to read and execute. Execute meaning move into that directory. Read meaning list the contents of the directory. But write, I cannot write to the contents of the directory. So I cannot create new files here. I cannot rename a file to another name, because that is essentially creating a new directory listing. I think that's probably the best way to think of it, is that you're manipulating or not the directory listing. And that really, I mean, that's a really weird distinction to make, and one I don't think we often do make. But it can be confusing, because if you think that the directory permissions sort of trickle down into other into its contents, then, I mean, in some ways that's true, but in a lot of ways that's not correct. And that itself, I think, can be confusing. And I think that if you really, really stretch and kind of remind yourself that the old adage that everything is a file, then you can kind of imagine a directory instead of imagining it as a physical like folder. I'm reaching around on my desk right now to pretend like I have a folder. I don't know why I think I have a folder on my desk. I don't have folders, but if I did, I would be picking one up right now. You know, instead of thinking of it as a folder where you put physical objects into, I do think that maybe the term directory is better, because if you think about a directory, I mean, what are the directories in your life? Probably not many, but the one that I can think of is like a phone book or a notebook or a reference book. You don't put things into those books, you look them up. And maybe like here's a D&D book, right? Dungeons and Dragons. And you've got, actually it's not a Dungeons and Dragons book. It's a Starfinder source book. But I mean it's a tabletop role-playing game book, right? And it's got a bunch of text in it that I look at frequently when playing games. I look at that text because I need values out of it. That's a directory listing. Now, if they come out with errata, which with Starfinder they do a lot, then maybe I need to change something in that book. And so I take a ballpoint pen, because I'm just, I do that sort of thing. I just write in books. I don't care. I'm not one of those people who cares. And I'll scratch something out and put in a new value. And that's because I have read and write permissions on that book. I can read it, but because I own pens, I can also write in the book. But I'm not generating a new page in the book, you know, like that's not something that you really, I don't populate that book with new entities. I just manipulate what's listed in it. And in a way, I think if you think of it that way, if you think of a directory as more of like a book with printed reference things in it and the file listing when you do an LS, rather than moving around a room rummaging through physical files on a desk, you're just looking at a list of the things that the desk or the room or whatever contains. It's a layer of weird abstraction that we don't think about, and I think a lot of the GUI applications out there has kind of trained us, for better or for worse, to think of it, to imagine it as a, you know, a physical sort of computer representations of physical object. But I think that can be confusing. And file permissions are confusing enough without that added layer of confusion. So I don't know, have a play around with all the different permissions, because it is really, really enlightening. If you sit down and actually go through sort of the exercise that I've just demonstrated, where you just cycle through the permissions for directories and then for the files and see how they interact with one another, see what you can and cannot do, you'll get a couple of surprises in there. There's more to it than this, not a whole lot more. There's a bit more to it than this. There are certainly umasks and setuid and setgid and obviously the sticky bit and all these other things that no one really talks about, but I don't know, probably arguably we should, but it's kind of edge case, so maybe we shouldn't. There's also a, you know, what happens when you do like plus capital X instead of plus X when you're granting executable permissions. Do you know? If not, look it up in the info file. It's kind of a mildly interesting tidbit of information. So that's the real story on Unix file permissions. It's not exactly what we've been told. It's different. It's more subtle than the real big generalities that we normally get, but I thought it was an interesting exercise to put them each to rigorous testing. That is what we have just done. It's definitely, definitely time for coffee. Let's go get some coffee. We'll come back. We'll read some listener email, talk a little bit about computer GUI dysphoria, and who knows what else. Let's go get coffee. And we're back. I have coffee. You should have coffee. I mean, really, you should have coffee. We just went through every single file permission in depth. So you should have coffee. This coffee is very good. Thank you. Hopefully yours is too. I wanted to kind of mention, kind of backtrack and mention what I was sort of hinting at there in the end of the file permission segment. I used to, and I think I've probably mentioned this before on the show, but it may as well be mentioned again. I used to, as a novice computer user, and I'm talking novice computer user, like not novice Linux user. This was way back before Linux. I used to honestly, I think that the objects, quote unquote, on the computer screen were objects, like physical objects. I mean, I knew that they weren't physical objects. I didn't think I was looking into a cardboard box full of actual physical tangible objects, but my understanding of them somehow were as if though they were physical, like the concept that a file could be spread across a disk, like the bits in a file could be spread across a disk. That never occurred to me. And it's funny that it never occurred to me, because you did used to hear a lot about defragging hard drives, where like there was this thing, I guess on some file systems it was a real thing, but there was this idea that sometimes your data started getting scattered too much across a disk, and so you needed a defrag application to look at a file, figure out what inodes its little parts were on, and gather those parts and put them into sort of a new inode spread that was closer together and free up space elsewhere. And the theory was that this would sort of, I don't know, make your computer go faster. And maybe it did. I don't know. I was never on an operating system and a file system that seemed to require that kind of maintenance. So who knows? But that was a thing a long time ago, so you might think, well, surely you would understand that files weren't like little digital bundles. But I feel like I thought that when there was a document icon on the screen, on like a desktop or something, and you moved that file icon into a folder, I mean, I think that you were moving it into a folder. I mean, I understood, again, that it was a digital representation of these things, but it still just kind of made sense to me, I guess, that it was a very exact simulation. And if you think about what that would take for a computer to simulate that, like you can imagine it, sort of, you know, you could think, okay, well, all right, so we'll cordon off some portion of the hard drive, and we'll draw a finite space, and we'll let the user put the documents into this finite space. And you would think, like, okay, well, if it's going to be a simulation of the real world, then eventually, I mean, like, even in the real world, if you have like a folder, physical folder on your desk, and you're cramming pages into it, eventually there's a limit. You know, it might be 100 pages, sheets of paper. It might be 200 sheets of paper. It might be 500 sheets of paper, depending on how big this folder is, I guess. But at some point, you can no longer fit more paper into that space. So you'd think that there would be like a sort of a limit on a computer if it was a true simulation. And boy, would that be annoying. But for some reason, the absence of a limitation never occurred to me. You know, that didn't break the illusion that somehow that digital object, the thing that they drew on the screen to help me understand, you can put documents into this folder like in real life. It never occurred to me that that wasn't a very true to life simulation. And there are lots of examples of that in computing, I think, where, I mean, even buttons and things like that, it just never really occurred to me that those weren't sort of tiles of some sort of like building construction kit inside of the computer. And again, I don't mean I ever thought that it was a physical, literal physical object. It's just my understanding of how code must work was that I guess I just thought that you just had physical, not physical, but digital simulations of physical objects that you could kind of string together. And eventually I think I started to understand that, yeah, but in order to make those physical simulations, there's like a bunch of text and stuff. And eventually I kind of understood that, yeah, to get those physical representations, it took a lot of typing. But I don't know that I ever understood that it went lower level, you know? I mean, like, I was very, very early, or not very early on, but the earliest introduction to the concept of code that I had was, for instance, HTML. And HTML, you know, is a little bit like that. You know, you can just, especially early HTML, you could just make things sort of happen because there'd be an image. You don't know how the image got there on your computer, but you knew that if you did an image tag, then you could use that image to represent, for instance, a button, and you could tell that button where to go, and so on. So it's very much, I mean, you know, like a scripting language, I guess. And that, I think, reinforced in a weird way sort of the magic of all of these computer things. It's just that the tiles, the building materials exist on your computer, and as long as you know the scripting language, the HTML or whatever, then you could make things appear and you could use those tools yourself and so on. And it took me a really long time, I think, to comprehend that what code actually looked like was, you know, like C or C++ or Java or Python or whatever. It took me a long time to kind of grasp that that's what computer code looked like. And I feel like in a weird way, that simplification that is inherent, I guess, in a GUI, it might be a little bit puzzling for people. It might be kind of distorting, you know, sort of reality for them, or their perception of reality, not literally distorting reality, but I think it might distort perception. I don't know how common that is, like the process that I had to go through to understand what was going on underneath the GUI. I don't know that's super common. I mean, I was very much brought up on a highly graphical system, so I feel like maybe it was somewhat unique. I don't know, or maybe it just, you know, maybe just my brain didn't make those connections, and maybe I'm the only person in the world not to make that connection. I don't know, but it did take a while, and I do wonder if, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I mean, I'm telling you, dear listener, that GUIs are overrated. I realize that this is not probably a hard sell to a lot of you. But I don't know, sometimes I kind of feel like GUIs are a little bit overrated. And I say that as someone who's running a GUI more often than not lately. I mean, honestly. I mean, that is to say, I boot to a GUI now on my Slackware system, whereas for years and years and years, I did not. And for a very long time, it was not even guaranteed that I would bother launching a GUI. Like, really? Like, I just didn't need it half the time. So, you know, I think lately I've been using a GUI a lot more often than I had been when I first switched to Linux. So, and yet I'm still saying that, yeah, I think graphical user interfaces are a little bit deceptive. They're a little bit potentially confusing. And that's just something, I guess, to be aware of. I don't know that there's an action item for that. I'm just saying that that's what happened with me. Okay, Deep Geek wrote in to weigh in on the CD topic, compact disc. He says, dear Klaatu, wanted to chime in on the issues of CD media on your podcast. First, let me say that I thought there was an elephant in the room, but I guess not. I myself use CD and DVD and USB media, but my CD and DVD media use is about me going to the public library, checking out CDs containing classical music and DVDs of movies and shows, some of which are ignored classics that you can't get merely by clicking around on the cable box. Since there was no mention of this, I guess my behavior is even rarer than I thought. Back when zombie apocalypse movies were in vogue, I used to say, hey, just hide in a public library. Nobody still alive finds me when I'm in there, so let alone if they're a zombie. But that's just a joke. So, yeah, this is Klaatu now. No, actually, Deep Geek raises a great point. Media, CDs, DVDs, things like that are alive and well in public libraries as well. I'm afraid I have to report a little bit that New Zealand, which is where I live right now and have lived for the past decade, so I guess saying right now is a little bit weird. So that's where I live in New Zealand. And public libraries here are not what you are maybe used to in at least America. I don't know about elsewhere because I've only lived in for any length of real time in America and New Zealand. So I'm just comparing those two because that's what I know. But in the U.S., in the USA, public libraries were honestly largely funded by Andrew Carnegie. He sort of kicked it off, apparently. That's what I've understood. And at least certainly the ones in my adult life that I've ever really frequented on a regular basis were all Carnegie libraries. So it was a big deal when public libraries in the U.S. got started that they would contain books that were free for everyone to borrow, $0 to borrow for some amount of time, and then they had to bring it back. In New Zealand, apparently, and I'm kind of, this is still something I'm reverse engineering and studying up on, but apparently in New Zealand, that was not necessarily ever an expectation. And libraries here, from what I gather, they don't have sort of the charter that you that they're necessarily $0. And so if you go to the public library in New Zealand, you'll find a whole bunch of books that are free to borrow, like $0. But you will also find books and especially media like CDs and DVDs that you have to pay to borrow. It's also not a given that there's any kind of interlibrary network. So in the U.S., you can go to a library, you can look up on the, for whatever reason, we still call it a card catalog, but it's usually on a computer. You can look up in the catalog for a book, and let's say they don't have the book there in the physical building that you're standing in. Well, if another library maybe across town has that book, then you can do an interlibrary loan where you ask for the book anyway. Even though it's physically not there, you can put in a sort of an order for that book, and the library across town will eventually, usually within a week or so, send the book to the other library, to your local library. And then you can go back to your local library and borrow the book because your library is borrowing the book from another library. It's called an interlibrary loan. And then you can bring that book back to your library or to the originating library if you happen to be across town that day and you've got the book with you and you think, oh yeah, I finished this, I might as well return it. So either, you know, it doesn't matter. And no, there's no penalty or anything like that. But in New Zealand, you, first of all, apparently I think you have to pay for the interlibrary loan in some places. And then I think there's a rule about where you're able to bring it back to. And then it also doesn't seem to be standardized across the country. It seems like the ones in Wellington were different than the ones here on the South Island. So it's a bit confusing to me. And for that reason, I haven't been to public libraries as often as I usually would be. I go there for books that I can't find elsewhere, but I don't know. I've always been kind of a paperback book person anyway. I really love just buying old, cheap, pulpy, science fiction and fantasy books from like secondhand bookstores and things like that. So honestly, at this point, I'm kind of enjoying that anyway. So the my reason to go to my local library has diminished in that sense. But also, there's just the fact that my local library doesn't have a whole lot of stuff that I'm all that interested in. They have some books here and there that I check out, but there's a lot of stuff that I just, yeah, it's just not there. And if I tried to get an interlibrary loan, it would be really complex and possibly it would cost money. And at that point, I might as well just go and spend, you know, $2 on some cheap pulp fiction book from the used bookstore or from Trade Me or something, which is the New Zealand version of eBay. And just own the thing outright and not bother with the loaning and bringing it back and so on. So that's kind of where I'm at right now with public libraries. And that's why in my real life experience, CDs and DVDs, which would have been normally quite common for me to get from the public library, it really hasn't been a thing for me since New Zealand. Prior to that, I used to go to libraries for CDs and DVDs all the time. And especially DVDs, I mean, because I had a graveyard shift for a while back in the U.S. And there's nothing like Nova nature documentaries at 2 a.m. until about 5 a.m. You know, like those wee small hours of the night, you need something. And a lot of times it would be just documentaries for me. And it was very enjoyable, but not really happening that much anymore. Okay. So he says, nevertheless, I think that we are a victim of our fellow purchasers of media in a certain way. You see, decent, long-lasting media costs more than bottom-dollar media. When all the other consumers in the market are demanding cheap, 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 the market responds by giving them what they want. I do think that the first few years of blank CDs would have lasted much longer than the recent year, the recent output of blank CDs. So in other words, this is Klaatu again, Deep Geek is saying that he believes that CD quality has gone down. And I'm inclined to believe that that could be true. I would still want proof. I mean, to me, in my mind, I did have early media at one point and didn't find it to be all that great. But maybe what's early to me isn't what early is to Deep Geek. Maybe he was, you know, if he was an earlier adopter of CDR than I was, then yeah, we could be talking about two different quote unquote early stages of that market. So he talks a little bit about how that expands out into other things. So for instance, like the quality of thumb drives and such aren't necessarily all the same, or even SD cards and things like that. I was talking to Ice Cream 95 about that on Mastodon. I think that's correct. I mean, I think that the market, I think that you do kind of have to look at what you're buying. The problem with saying that though, is that what do you look for? It's not like they mark themselves really. They don't warn you, hey, I'm going to, short circuit in 3 months, or, you know, I'm going to snap between your fingers while you're trying to push me into the Raspberry Pi SD card slot. They don't tell you that on the packaging. So and it's easy to look at packaging and just think, well, this one looks really fancy, I guess, and it feels like it's pretty expensive, so this is probably good quality. And then you purchase it, and you know, 3 months later, the drive has died on you because you wrote too many bits to it, too, you know, over the course of time. And I know that solid state media has a finite lifespan and so on. At least that's what they tell me. I mean, honestly, I've got a ridiculous 16 gigabyte. I've talked about this before. I got a 16 gig SSD drive that I got ages ago, and it's still running. It's now powering a backup, or not a backup, but like a spare computer in my little home lab. It boots to Magia 8 right now, just for fun, and it's great, you know, because it makes this ridiculously old Intel Core 2 Duo desktop that I have acquired from a local business that was going to throw it out, and it makes it run relatively respectably, really. It's actually, it's really, really impressive. I'm going to talk about that a little bit when we go over XFCE, because that's what I'm using it as, is my experiment for XFCE. So it's apparently, yes, they have a finite lifespan, as most things in life do, and yet it does seem to be wildly variable, because I definitely have had USB thumb drives, for instance, that don't last very long, versus this SSD drive that everyone was telling me, oh, you better be careful, those things don't last for very long, they're going to die on you, and when they die, they give you no warning, and all these other stories that I've heard about how horrible SSD drives could be. And yet my oldest one is still functioning really, really, actually, yeah, and I've got a 500 gig one that's still working quite well as well. I've got these things that are, they're ancient, and they seem to, and I don't know how I stumbled across really good quality ones, because I didn't know I was buying good quality. I was just buying names that I vaguely recognized. So it's difficult. And I think that's kind of part of the problem, really. And by problem, I mean problem. Like, it's just, I don't know. Capitalism, I don't think, is a perfect system. Let's put it that way. And this is one aspect of capitalism that I think betrays much about it. And that is that the market demands cheap, the market provides cheap, but fails to distinguish between the two, cheap and quality. Doesn't let you know which is which. Well, that's because obviously better profits are possible if they don't tell you and just everything's cheap, but they make the packaging look higher quality or lesser quality. So it's a good system if your only win condition is making maximum profits, but not for much else, interestingly. So that's Deep Geek's email, and I think that's about everything I have for this episode. Thanks for listening. Hopefully the long journey through the file permissions was either enlightening or at least sometimes surprising to you. Thanks for hanging out. Let's talk again, this time next week.